Very short.
Okay, that's it.
I'll leave it to myself.
Lisa?
Yes?
Well, what I did was, knowing that we've all read the chapter, I kind of, in one column I wrote about, basically what it was about, in the other column I wrote about things that I thought about, so kind of how I'm going to talk about this evening. And so I'll start off with a quote. Well, I think it's a quote, it comes from the end of the article. Humans can, or the human an instrument, it's the best instrument to capture the joint and multiple meanings of the human experience. I think that was the whole, to me, that's the gist of the article, was that that there are flaws in the qualitative research domain, and we've all, I think, talked about what that means, breaking things down into variables and cause and effect and loss of empathy and all that sort of thing. And if you truly want to understand your subject, you need to, the best tool we have so far is ourselves, because we are that complex, so we can perhaps understand the complexity a little bit more. And as I was reading about that, I thought back to a seminar from another course that Fiona, she gave a presentation on artificial intelligence, which is a field of technology, and what's happening in that field. Fiona, sorry if I misinterpreted what you're saying. But Fiona talked an awful lot about, just the presentation. There are different technologists who strive to sort of capture the human essence in a computer. It's done for different reasons. Some are to teach you, so you've got cognitive tutors in a computer, and they're supposed to replace the human being to teach people incrementally. So, if you're trying to learn how to do a certain math problem, it would give you prompts and say, do this, think about that. It's supposed to sort of replicate being human. So that this whole rebellion against the quantitative style research made me think of that in a big way. But so did the qualitative research a little bit too, in some way, in that what I was talking about before, and that it too is trying to come up with a formula for how we should go about that type of research. And I think what I got from that was, as humans, we're the best tool we have to understand ourselves, but we still don't understand ourselves well enough to be a useful tool.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
So that basically summed up, I can talk about what the different parts of the paper, but that basically summed up what I thought about pretty much through the whole thing. Would you like me to go on more? Or?
Yeah, I would. That was fascinating.
Okay.
So far. I love that.
All right. So the traditional approach, he talks about that the world can be broken down into smaller joints, smaller parts, and that reality is quantifiable. I thought a lot about the Spinelli article, that bracketing is not possible. Okay, that reminded me of the artificial intelligence thing again. Whereas we're the human instrument, you're trying. If we're supposed to go about analyzing things, we're supposed to bracket our experience. That to me is we're striving to be a qualitative tool. Like we're striving to make ourselves as non-human as possible in order to use our human self to understand something. Like we're trying to be as neutral as we possibly can, and that just didn't make sense to me. Although I understand why.
Are we trying to be neutral?
That's the way I read that. I read that you were supposed to put your experiences to side while you were, or be aware of them, but
yeah.
Not, you know?
Yeah. Like, doesn't it the same as being neutral?
No.
I think it's more that you're just trying to be conscious.
Yeah.
Consciously aware of what kinds of things, you know, what's going on when you're making an interpretation, when you're coming up with some kind of, theme, and you're thinking through how it relates something, and
mm-hmm.
you want to be conscious of that,
and you don't want to be prevented from seeing mm-hmm. what's new,
because
mm-hmm.
that's right, because you're only framing it one way,
mm-hmm.
which is your own way of thinking about it. I think so.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that's more that than
mm-hmm.
neutral.
Yeah, neutral is probably not the best trait for it. Not sure if that's how you say his name, Polanyi.
Mm-hmm.
He provided a framework for building and improving skills of the human as instrument. he was trying to improve upon the trustworthiness of the naturalist inquiry, of the field of naturalist inquiry, and I'm just obsessed with this concept of qualitative research, really being very formulaic. Yeah. And the fact that he was a Hungarian born chemist made me very suspicious.
The chemist part.
To me, that was, you know, I'm assuming, I know nothing about this poor man, but I'm assuming he came from a very scientific background. He's used to linear patterns. And for him to try and improve upon the human as instrument, tool, it just made me suspicious. I don't know why. Do you understand what I mean?
Sort of, yeah.
Yep. Okay. He talked about, so Polanyi, I think, made reference to, I can't remember who it was, somebody, Plato maybe, who said, looking for how we gain new knowledge. I didn't write it down here and I thought I would remember, but I don't. Mm-hmm. So, he talked about tacit knowledge that we have but we cannot state, and we interpret our feelings. We interpret meanings into our feelings, but they're not stated. I'm not speaking properly because it's late in the.
Yeah, that's all right. You're doing very well.
Yeah. You may break into French any moment.
No, I won't do that. But just this whole concept of trying to understand people's meanings when they're not explicitly stated, and he talked about trying to get somebody to explain how they did sport activity.
Yeah.
That reminded me of what you were just talking about earlier. Mm-hmm. And it's very difficult to teach people a physical activity like that. It's hard to break it down into steps. And he brought that up. They talked about using the human as instrument. To make summaries of people's experiences, that we would be able to do that. And the qualitative research would involve the reading of a situation, and that reading would be a process of looking both forwards and backwards. And I think Scholes tried to define that by making a metaphor for it, and I think he said that it was a linear. He gave it a linear pattern at first, and then he said, that didn't work. It was more, I think he used the word centrifugal, meaning circular, and that didn't work. And then, he decided in the end that he was going to take a whole bunch of different metaphors and lay them on top of one another, and wherever the circles intersected, that would be what he learned from them. Mm-hmm. And that just seems like another pattern again to me, so... Yeah.
Yeah, but then our world is pattern-driven, isn't it? There's attempt. Meaning is the whole human condition of trying to construct meaning is about trying to construct a pattern that would then mean so that there would be meaning. So I don't think I think that's okay. I mean, we don't have chaos.
No.
Theory equivalents for for thinking about, qualitative issues or phenomenological or subjective experience issues.
Yeah, I think I was just saying that both fields of research have a similar common goal, which is to illuminate meaning, really. That's what I came up with, but they go about it in a different way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, or you think positivism is about illuminating meaning?
I'm thinking that right now. Am I wrong about
that? I would disagree with
would
that.
Would you?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think it's more about contributing to knowledge.
Okay. Is that not illuminating meaning, or?
Do you think knowledge and meaning are the same?
I think no. Not if we're talking about facts or that kind of knowledge, no.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you can, the idea is you can interpret knowledge in different ways. You can look at knowledge as a different kind of, from different angles within different frames.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so that's more what happened. I mean, the thing that I was speaking to you about last week, I think it's still hard to get to this perhaps point yet, where I'm talking about the realms and the different ideas about space and time and all that.
what it does address to is this issue that you've brought up, that at the end of the day, we are arguing for qualitative research as a social science, as a way of doing science.
Mm-hmm.
Even though we're saying we're doing it differently,
mm-hmm.
we're still doing science, and it has a structure. And if it didn't have a structure, we're saying social reality is nonetheless a real thing,
mm-hmm.
even if you don't believe it exists as a thing. It exists as a perceived thing. Okay? Mm-hmm. And it's the perceived thing that we study. Once we say it's a perceived thing is now a real thing, it has a structure.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to equate it with structure. And what its structure is ontologically different from the material world structure and the natural sciences. But, for example, memory is a good example. Memory doesn't have a particular, let me see, I had a lecture note here, Okay, memories are given as this phenomenal status because they lack spatiality. And they follow a principle of regularity other than that of causality. Doesn't mean they lack a structure, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they don't follow the spatial, time, Newtonian, Euclidean, right? So as such, we can to study them within that, you know, which was problematic. So, and memory is also, it's a kind of presence. Okay, it as such, it doesn't present a problem then to treat it like a thing as perceived, right? A real thing. And it's once something, you give something the status of being real, then it's got a structure.
Mm.
Doesn't mean we can always illuminate that structure, all parts of the structure, or, you know, all components, or whatever you want to say would equate with structure. But the point, we can't lose that from our thinking about qualitative research, because if we do, then we're not saying it's accessible anymore. For being studied, it would no longer be accessible in such a way that it can be communicated to others in time and space. So we need to bring it back into that time-space area, and that's what text and talk does ultimately. We get data that's sent back in that particular. It doesn't mean that the content of the text or talk may float all over the place. I did this yesterday and it reminded me of when I was 5, and then, you know, eventually I hope I do this. You know, that's moving around, right? Just like subjectivity is fluid and will, and it's changeable. But that thing that we're making accessible to study, the thing as perceived, is a memory, in this case, a memory, we have to say has a structure, and that can be communicated to others. Merleau-Ponty talks a lot about this point, and he says that a phenomenon does not represent an inaccessible inner world, but rather the external world perceived in a particular way.
Mm-hmm.
So, and for you to perceive something, it has to have a structure. Slava likes to talk to me, and we debate this a lot, that what we should perhaps be using is the word form. Now, that's problematic too, but that what we're really speaking about with qualitative research is we're looking at a form as opposed to a structure. And you can go into that, you know, intellectually, you can have a good debate about that, but it makes a lot of sense why you want to conceptualize it as a form. And I think somehow the way you've been posing your questions, that might sit better with you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the idea of a form that something has, rather than, because a form doesn't necessarily have to, its structure isn't necessarily. Okay, let me give you an example.
Lots of examples in Foucault on that sort of thing where it's just the one of those idiosyncratic, particularly human things where there's a structure and we all participate in it and uphold
mm-hmm.
it.
Mm-hmm.
It is there. There is a structure, and it's this sort of mystery on how we
mm-hmm.
all
yes.
participate in
it. That's the part that gets me.
Yeah.
Yeah, but there is a structure,
mm-hmm.
definitely.
Wittgenstein also takes up that idea. And he says, ultimately, philosophy is itself, meaning that's all there is what is how you think about something, mm-hmm. right? And how you philosophize or theorize whatever or something. It becomes the thing itself, and that and he talks about it in terms of forms. Okay, a form of life, although he only ever uses that once, but it becomes a real Wittgensteinian term mm-hmm. out there, is that Wittgenstein talks about forms of life, which are these things that become ultimately mysteries, you know, when you try to look, because they are so multi-layered and so complex.
I think the thing is we're using a two-dimensional platform, we're using paper and words to talk about something that I see as very three-dimensional and...
No, I think that's true. Mm-hmm. I absolutely. And that's the best that we've got.
Yes.
Available.
Oh, yes.
I was just thinking when you were saying that, this fleeting thought that's gone now. I'm tired too. But it was along the lines of Wittgenstein, yeah, the forms of life. It's gone. It'll come to me another day. It's really, what you're thinking about is really important. You're thinking at a really strong philosophical level. It's hard.
It hurts.
What I would hope is that we don't, oh, I know it. Here's my fleeting thought. Okay. I can't help but feel that you're equating to some extent this idea of structure with the idea of reductionism.
I think that's what I'm doing. I think I'm doing the Derrida thing, maybe, trying to get...
No, more positivist, notions of reductionism. And I think that's definitely not what we're after. And that just because something is... We're giving... Because we're acknowledging a structure to something doesn't mean we're involving reductionism.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think if you can separate those out, it'll probably help a lot.
Yeah.
You're seeing reductionism in everything. Every time, you know, somebody's made a list or someone wrote a method out for you of how to do something, you're seeing reductionism mm-hmm. in everything.
Because when I read, I think, chapters 4 and 5, it talked about
reducing a complex phenomenon down
series will
come to
you
no longer, ultimately, no longer the
how can you put
the opposite of the
question. Put that into the formula? I don't know.
Yeah.
I guess we have.
Yeah. Mm. So you're right, and that, of course that's the thing. Ultimately, we're trying to avoid, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
But let's face it, it's a complex phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
We're never going to get at it, and it's in its entirety. So there will always be that element.
Yeah. In the field of AI, they've created a chess program that can beat the best chess player. So when I think of I don't know whether to think of that as a program, you know, taking a very, very small part of your brain and how you think, and it's...
That's exactly right, yeah.
Yeah.
Because all the chess-playing computer can do is play chess.
Mm-hmm. That's all it can do.
Yeah. But by doing enough of those and having, okay, well, here's the chess-playing computer, here's the computer that maps how we do this, here's the computer that... I mean, it's ultimately that presentation of mine was saying that AI is trying to reverse... engineer a human's mm-hmm. brain, basically. Mm-hmm. We're trying to figure out how we do things because mm-hmm. we're trying to understand ourselves.
Yeah. But that computer cannot transcend.
No, it can't. It can't do anything.
Or transform mm-hmm. In the what we would consider creative process,
mm-hmm.
right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
So ultimately, new possibilities are there mm-hmm. beyond the reach of the computer. You know, if you believe that human mind is able to do those kinds mm-hmm. of things, which we have lots of examples of. You know, mm-hmm. So we have to believe there is that. And then you get to the realms, too, the mystical. And if you want to go that far. Maybe not this time. Yes. Not without a bottle of wine in front of us.
So now that's an idea.
Okay. But mm-hmm. I love your thinking, and thanks for sharing it. I mean, it's challenging.
Mm-hmm. You'll know how confused I am.
I'm glad you talked about it, because I think ultimately you got there with something in identifying reductionism. That's how, you know, now if you think about that now, you'll be able to look at some of these things and say, okay, well, that really isn't reductionism, mm-hmm. what that's trying to do. That's, you know, that's just doing something different.
Mm-hmm.
It's harder, too, when you're sort of combating
the
conventional way of thinking. It's sort
mm-hmm.
of, if you're sort of you know, apprenticed in this from the very beginning. It's,
well, yeah. I love interpretation. Yeah. I love interpreting things. And
this is what happens to people. I've never seen anybody bite the apple of knowledge and qualitative and then want to go back. Mm-hmm. That's the problem. It can damage you for the future because, you know, it opens you up to possibilities but it's also incredibly frustrating when you go back to other colleagues, you know, because it's so hard to explain and you don't know where to start with the explanation. You can't use the terminology, the concepts we've studied so intensely already. You can't because they're not familiar concepts. It's very hard.
Mm-hmm. Doesn't need models.
No, exactly.
Doesn't need models.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but yet it's a messy model. Feels so